Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Happy to be with you on this Tuesday. We got open forum for you both hours, so you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. If you're not familiar with the format, open forum, first of all, is open to anyone, whether you are Catholic or not, whether you are a religious person or not. Anybody can call 888-318-7884 and open to anything. And we really mean that, open to anything, especially when Jimmy's here. And Jimmy's here with us the first hour. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cyril Kellett.
Thanks for being here with us.
Yeah, no problem. It's been a few hours since you and I worked together.
I know. Hours have passed.
And talking about the openness of topics, I mean, when we spoke earlier, today we recorded an episode of Catholic Answers Focus that will be coming out, I guess, in a few weeks. And the topic for that was science. So
yeah,
yay science.
Go science. So if you got science questions, that'd be a lot of fun. 888-318-7884. What drops? I was going to say tomorrow, but no, you're usually with us Thursdays, but this is a Tuesday. Mm-hmm. So Friday, what drops?
It's an analysis of the sleeping prophet, a man named Edgar Cayce, who lived in the first part of the 20th century and the last part of the 19th. He would go into a trance and give psychic readings for people on different subjects. Last week we told his life story, and so this week we're looking at the evidence of what would explain what happened with him. Was it purely natural? Was he paranormal? Was it paranormal? Did he have genuinely psychic abilities? Was it some mix of things? Mm-hmm. What was his accuracy rate? What was his inaccuracy rate? Things like that.
Is this do they have film of him? Because he died in the film age already, right?
Well, I know they have. I mean, there are pictures of him that, yeah, you know, still pictures. I haven't seen any video footage of him. I have heard audio footage of him or sound recordings of him in a trance. We played one of them last week just so people could hear his voice. Mm-hmm. But I'm not aware. I'm sure there are home movies or something somewhere, but I've never seen them.
Again, 888-318-7884, the number here. If you want to see Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, just go to, I never can get this,
mysterious.fm.
That's so easy. Why do I have trouble with that one? Mysterious.
Because it's new.
Yeah. Mysterious.fm, or just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You pretty much can't miss it. It's right there in the middle of the internet. You'd have to step over it to get around. So 888-318-7884, the number. Let's see who we got. Let's start out with Ryan in Midland, Texas, listening on the app. Ryan, good to talk with you again. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
All right. My question is, and I have a follow-up if you've got the time. It's about saints.
Okay.
When the church approves the last miracle in order to canonize someone as a saint, how does the church determine what the soon-to-be saint will be the patron or patroness of?
Well, they don't typically do that. Most saints are not declared to be the patron of anything in particular. When someone they become the patron of something in a variety of different ways. Sometimes it's by people just appealing to that person for a particular need and it catches on. They also, if like a church is named after them, well, then they become the patron saint of that church. And that's a decision that's made, you know, by the local bishop, often in consultation with the first pastor of a church when a church is established. And occasionally the Pope will declare them a patron of something. But it's not like every single saint is a declared formal patron of something.
All right. Yeah, we got time then for that follow up. Go ahead, Ryan.
All right. About a year ago, I discovered that Maximilian Kolbe is the patron saint of people who speak a language called Esperanto, among other things he's the patron of. But I was wondering, how can some saints like him and others be the patrons of things they may not have been very well known for?
Well, you know, people have limitations in this life, but what being a patron of essentially means is that you will pray for people who have a particular need or interest or activity. And so it wouldn't require you to speak Esperanto to be the patron saint of Esperanto speakers. It would just require you being willing to respond to their prayer requests. And so if you have, since the saints in heaven are willing to respond to prayer requests from people on earth, and since they're perfectly loving, they're not going to discriminate between people and say, ooh, Esperanto, I'm not going to pray for those people. So if Esperanto speakers start appealing to Maximilian Kolbe or anybody else and asking the saint to intercede on their behalf, then they thereby become a patron of those people.
Thank you very much, Ryan. I hope it was helpful to you. Thank you.
Go ahead. Also in heaven, you know, we get all the knowledge that we need. And so if Maximilian Kolbe or whomever, and I don't know if he did or didn't speak Esperanto during his life, but if he needed to know Esperanto in order to adequately serve the needs of these people, then he could learn it in heaven by direct download from God.
Indeed, he could. Well, let me ask you this, Jimmy. What mm-hmm. exactly is Esperanto? I know it's a language that was intended to be, I guess, easily learned by anyone on Earth. It's still going?
Not anybody on Earth. Oh. It's what's known as a constructed language or a conlang. And there are other conlangs like Klingon and Old High Elvish and things like that. And they're based on one or more existing languages, and that's what Esperanto is. Esperanto has a kind of simplified grammar that's based on European languages. Its root vocabulary is based on common roots in European languages, so it's heavily influenced by Indo-European, which was a language that gave birth over millennia to the different European languages. And so if you're familiar with a European language like French or German or Spanish or something like that, then you'll already come to Esperanto knowing a good number of the words because it'll have cognates in your own language. And so that'll make it easier for someone who speaks an Indo-European language to learn. But it won't necessarily make it easier for someone who learned a language from a different language family altogether. Like if you, for example, are a native speaker of Mandarin Chinese, you're not going to have the same experience with Esperanto because you won't know the root stock that the vocabulary comes from. And Esperanto, like Mandarin, uses some concepts that are simply not found in European languages. Mandarin is a tonal language, which means in addition to vowels and consonants, you also change the pitch of your voice in different ways as you speak it. So if you raise the pitch of your voice as you say a syllable, let's say the syllable is schwa. If you say schwa, then that will mean something completely different than if you use a descending pitch like schwa, or if you use a circumflex pitch like schwa. And so tones are used in some languages, but not in others, and they're not used in Esperanto, for example.
I gotcha. Do you know, are there a lot of speakers of Esperanto? I know you know about this because you know, you're Jimmy Aiken.
Well, there are a respectable number. Esperanto is not, the native language of any country on Earth.
Right.
But it is used, and it's one of the more successful conlangs. I don't know if there are more Esperanto speakers or Klingon speakers, but it is certainly one of the most successful conlangs.
I'm sorry, but it would be funny if Klingon were the dominant of those. I don't know why, but that would be funny. Joseph in Florida, listening on the app, the Catholic Answers Live app. Thanks for downloading the app, Joseph, onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, good evening, guys.
Good evening.
Hey, so a little bit of a backstory. My wife struggles with charity. And so she struggles finding moments of charity or even tithing and how much we should tithe and so forth. And so I guess sometimes I get worried because of Matthew 25 regarding the sheep and the goats. So my question would be, with me you know, with the one flesh idea regarding matrimony, does my charitable works have any effect on her and her salvation?
Well, so there is something to this idea of a kind of mystical union between husband and wife that has spiritual effects on other members of the family. It's something that St. Paul talks about in his letters. At one point, he talks about how an unbelieving spouse, so this means someone who's not Christian at all, is sanctified through the believing spouse, and he indicates that this has effects on the children as well, that the children are somehow sanctified through the believing spouse. So there is something to this idea. However, in terms of fundamental salvation, that's an individual thing. And so it involves the will of the person who's involved. If they close their will fundamentally to God's grace, then they would not be saved, even if their spouse and all the rest of the members of their family are. On the other hand, if they are open to God's grace and actively receive it, even if they're not perfect people, well, that's what purgatory is for. They'd still be saved, but they'd need some purification before they experience, you know, full heaven. If they are open but don't actively embrace God's grace, or you know, there are some issues, well, the sanctification they acquire through their believing spouse could be of some benefit to them, but their situation's more ambiguous. So we can't save our spouses by, like, being extra good Christians, but we can help our spouses. And so that's a good thing. And unless your wife is, you know, in mortal sin, she will go to heaven, even if she needs purification first. So, if she is living a Christian life, even if it's not perfect, as long as she's not living a life of conscious, known mortal sin on her part, then there's every reason to be optimistic about her salvation.
Okay, Joseph?
Sounds good.
Okay, it does sound good. Yeah, thank you very, very much. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live. Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Faith is a precious gift from God. As the largest religious media network in the world, EWTN has an important role in educating others about our Catholic faith and spreading the good news of salvation. We invite you to explore our numerous pages of historical faith documents, prayers, teachings, and other current issues in Catholicism today. Visit EWTN.com and click Catholicism. EWTN, the global Catholic network.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. It's Catholic Answers annual conference week on Thursday and Friday of this week. We'll do the show from the conference. So if you're coming, we'd love it if you'd join us on Thursday from the lobby of the hotel, and on Friday from the ballroom where all the big talks will be. Jimmy will be among those giving talks. And you can still come if you want, but we only have talks-only passes. So if you want to come hear the talks, I think it's quite reasonable, the rate for talks only. You just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com and get those tickets and come on by. And I'm sure that with the talks-only pass that you can come to the radio broadcast if you want. I'm sure of it. I'm sure of it.
Well, it's in a lobby, so, you know.
It'd be hard to keep you out on it.
Exactly.
I guess maybe I made that sound a little better than it actually is. Yeah. As a matter of fact, if you just happen to be walking through the lobby of the Hyatt Aventine on Thursday, you can come to the show. 888-318-7884 is the number, and you are welcome to call with whatever your question is, whether you're Catholic or not. It's Open Forum today with Jimmy Akin. And up next, we go to Carolyn in Bishop, California, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Carolyn, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question regarding purgatory. So I okay. have a Protestant friend. I have mm-hmm. a Protestant friend who says, well, where in the Bible does it state that, you know, there's such a thing as purgatory? Because she believes that we're both saints and sinners by believing in Jesus, and that we would just go straight to heaven. And I had told her that only, you know, if saints go to heaven, you know, and are in paradise with Jesus. So we need to go through this purification in purgatory. And so I want to know how to explain that in depth to
okay.
her.
Well, I, you know, this being a call-in radio show, I can't give you an in-depth answer. What I can do is give you a brief answer and then recommend resources where you can get in-depth information. So in terms of a brief answer, the idea of purgatory for historical reasons is frequently opposed by our Protestant friends, although actually these days there are a number of Protestants who are more open to the idea. And part of what helps people be more open to it is realizing what it actually is. It's really the final stage of something that our Protestant friends believe in. They believe that after we have been forgiven our sins and are in a state of grace or saved, that God continues to work in our lives to make us holy. And that process in Protestant theology is referred to as sanctification. It's the process by which we grow in God's grace and we become more loving and more Christ-like. But they also recognize that it is a process. It's not something that happens in a single moment. It's something that occurs over the course of the Christian life. And so there's then a question, well, are most people perfectly loving? Are most people perfectly Christ-like or perfectly holy by the time they die? And for most people, Christian experience indicates they're not. They may have grown a lot as Christians over their life, but they're not perfect at this point. However, they will be perfect in heaven, and that's something our Protestant friends acknowledge. There's not going to be sinning in heaven. We're not going to be imperfect. We're not going to be suffering from temptations and disordered desires and things like that. And so that what that means is between the point of death, where you're still imperfect, and the point where you're in the full glory of heaven, where you will be perfect, there must be a purification, a final stage of sanctification accomplished by God's grace. And we don't know a whole lot about how that works. It may take time. It may happen in the twinkling of an eye, but it's there. And that essentially is what purgatory is. It's just the final stage of sanctification. And when you explain it in those terms that makes the concept clear, it becomes a lot more intelligible and a lot more acceptable to folks coming from a Protestant background. Various Protestants, for example, like C.S. Lewis, believed in purgatory, and he wrote about purgatory. So it's not something that Protestants can't accept. It's just something that's not typically on their mental maps because they've never had it explained in that way. In terms of where it is in the Bible, well, we could deduce it simply from the principles that I laid out, which, you know, all have biblical bases. But there are some passages that do refer to aspects of purgatory. One of them is not in the Protestant Bible, but it's in the Old Testament book known as 2 Maccabees. In 2 Maccabees, Judah Maccabee and his associates find the bodies of some soldiers who were fighting for Israel. They were fighting on God's side, but they also superstitiously had some amulets on them. And they realize that that these men had sin, which they had apparently not repented of when they died. And so they arranged to do two things for these men. One of the things that they do is they take up a collection so that they can have a sacrifice made for them in Jerusalem at the temple. And that's the Old Testament equivalent of having Mass said for someone. They also pray for the people who died with this unrepented sin. Now, they died in God's grace. They were fighting for God, but they were still imperfect. And so they pray for them. And that indicates a belief that that our prayers can have an effect, a positive effect for people who are in the afterlife, but who need purification from things that they had done. Now, as I said, this book is not in the Protestant Bible, but it is a Jewish book from before the time of Christ. And that shows that this belief that the prayers of the living can help the dead be purified from sins they committed in life is something that was part of the true religion before the time of Christ. And it continued in not only in Christianity, in Catholicism and in Eastern Orthodoxy, it also continued in Judaism. Modern Jews pray for their departed loved ones. And so it's something that that is broad-based. It's part of the Judeo-Christian faith more broadly. In the New Testament, which is, of course, in the Protestant Bible, there's the book of 1 Corinthians. And in 1 Corinthians 3, St. Paul talks about how all of our works, will, when we stand before God, will be tested by fire. And he says if we've built badly during life, then our works will be burned up, but we will be saved, and it will be like escaping through flames, like running out of a burning building. But we'll still be saved. And so this passage indicates that there can be negative consequences even for saved people in the afterlife. And so that would indicate that something like purgatory must take place, that what we've done is going to be tested and we can suffer negative consequences if we haven't built well, to use Paul's language, in this life, but we'll still be saved. And so we're not talking here about damned people, but genuinely saved people may still have some consequences of what they did in this life that needs to be dealt with. And that's essentially an aspect of purgatory. Now, I mentioned that I'd recommend some resources. We have a lot of resources on purgatory at Catholic.com. You can just go to Catholic.com, put in the word purgatory, and a bunch of stuff will come up. Also, Carlo Broussard has a book with the ultra 1960s title, Purgatory is for Real. I mean, they just should have added
the word man.
Exactly. They should have added the word man on the end of that.
Right.
And we also have 20 answers on purgatory, I believe. And so we have quite a number of resources, many of them online for free, and also some books you can purchase.
Carolyn, thanks. Actually, if you want a copy of Purgatory is for Real, just hang on the line and Edgar will see that it gets sent to you. We just need an address to send it to. But thanks, Carolyn. Thanks very much. Let's go to Thomas in Temecula, California, watching on YouTube. Temecula, just up the road from where we are here. Thomas, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for having me. So, yes, my questions are concerning the degrees of holy orders versus the sacramental character of holy orders. Mm-hmm. So, as a premise, it is it not true, at least in theory, that in the next life we will be able to see, per se, the sacramental characters of others as permanent marks on the soul? And then following this line of thought, being that the sacraments of holy orders has three degrees, namely deacon, priest, and bishop, would we be able to further distinguish the degrees of these marks on the soul?
Well, we really don't know the answer. We're not told the answer to this in Scripture, and the Church doesn't have a teaching on it. It does say that these marks are permanent on our souls, but it doesn't have a teaching on will they be visible to us in some way, or perceivable. You know, even if they're not visual, you might be able to somehow just perceive, oh, this person is baptized and this person is confirmed and this person is ordained. It may be that that is the case, but we aren't told that it's the case. And so I would put this in a category of speculation. One could speculate that these sacramental characters will be visible or perceivable to us in the afterlife, but we don't have confirmation that that will be the case. So we'd want to be a little careful in our speculation and not say it's absolutely certain that this will happen.
Thomas, thank you very, very much. I hope that was helpful to you. I appreciate that. Maybe we'll see you someday because you're not too far from us. I wanted to get you, before we have to go to the break, Jimmy, because I think this will be a fairly quick one, and I'm actually curious about it. Jason on Facebook asked, when Paul was headed to trial before Caesar, would it really have been Caesar himself or just a magistrate or an appointee who heard the case?
Well, it depends on which trial of Paul you're talking about. As a Roman citizen, Paul had a right to have his case heard, the one we read about in the book of Acts. He had a right to have that heard by Caesar, and it meant Caesar himself.
Oh, okay.
And so the Caesar at the time was Nero, and it is widely thought, based on various pieces of historical evidence, that Paul's case was heard by Nero and that Nero acquitted him. But there's more to the story, and I'll tell that on the other side of the break.
Oh, very interesting. All right. Well, Jason, thanks for the question on Facebook. We'll take a very quick break and be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin. If you'd like to call, we got two lines open, 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, Gripped by Guilt.
Caught in the Grasp of Guilt will help you find hope and healing.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. Next hour, Jim Blackburn will be here with us. So lots of opportunities for you to get in and ask your question. And please feel welcome. Whatever your status is, whether you're Catholic or not, Christian or not, religious or not, you are very welcome here. 888-318-7884. I'm actually a little bit surprised. Jason asked a question on Facebook about when Paul headed to trial before Caesar, would it really have been Caesar or just a magistrate? I actually thought it'll probably just be a magistrate, you know, Caesar's corporate. You said, no, a Roman citizen is tried by Caesar.
Well, they at least in principle, it can happen, yes.
Okay.
They have a right to appeal to Caesar. Now, Caesar could always say, I'm not here in that guy's case. But in principle, he did. And Caesar's actually were much more involved than a lot of people would think. In fact, Caesar had to personally be present for a lot of government business to be conducted. He was, for example, a magistrate, you know, a judge, and the Caesars worked in the court system hearing cases. Also, Caesar had to be present for any kind of public meeting of a governmental nature to take place.
Oh.
He couldn't, if he didn't show up one day, let's say he's sick, then the meeting doesn't happen. He had to be personally involved. And so there's evidence, like I was saying, that St. Paul was tried before Nero around AD 60, because that's when the Book of Acts cuts off. And although not everybody agrees with this, there is significant evidence that he was acquitted then, because it was before AD 64, which is when the persecution of – that's when the Great Fire of Rome happened. And then either in late 64 or in 65, the persecution of Christians began because Nero wanted to deflect blame on them for the fire of Rome. And there's evidence that St. Paul experienced a number of years of freedom in the early 60s, and that he fulfilled his aspiration to go evangelize in Spain,
mm-hmm.
and then later returned and was arrested. And that it's during his second arrest that he wrote the pastoral epistles, you know, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus. And he was then martyred during the reign of Nero, most likely in AD 67, most likely in the middle of AD 67. And so it's said that he died under Nero, but that doesn't mean that on the second occasion Nero heard his case personally, because in 67, Nero wasn't in Rome. He took an extensive trip to Greece, where he competed in various competitions of an athletic or poetic or, you know, musical nature. And guess what? He won them all.
He was just really good at stuff. He was amazing. Nobody could beat him.
His dying words were, "What an artist dies with me." But while he was in Greece, you know, someone had to stay back and mind the store. And so a couple of his servants of his, one was a freedman named Helios, and another was named Nymphidius. They were running the show back in Rome, and it's likely that it was one of them that sentenced St. Paul to death at his second trial. And we have evidence for that in the book of First Clement, which was probably written in the first half of the year AD 70. Nero was gone by this point. The Senate declared him an enemy of the state in mid 68, and he committed suicide. And then we had this disastrous year of four emperors in 69. And then First Clement gets written in the first half of 70, before the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in August of 70. Because Clement refers to the temple as still in operation. So we have pretty good evidence that's when it was written. Well, Clement says that St. Paul preached in the furthest parts of the West. And if you're in Rome, you're kind of in the middle of the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
You know, that's where Italy is. So the furthest parts of the West, from your perspective, that's going to be Spain. And Paul had said in the letter to the Romans he wanted to go to Spain. So it looks like he was able to do that. And Clement says that after preaching in the furthest parts of the West, he was executed under the governors, plural. And that's probably a reference to the gentleman that Nero left in charge while he was on his extensive trip to Greece.
I'm really glad Jason asked that question. That's fascinating. And Paul beheaded, not crucified like Peter, because he's a Roman citizen, right? You can't crucify
Correct.
A Roman citizen.
You can't. I mean, maybe it happened sometimes, but you're not supposed to crucify a Roman citizen. Yes. And so Paul was beheaded.
Peggy in San Antonio is up next, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Peggy, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi there. I was just curious. The practice of saving a body part from a holy person or a saint, where did that come into being, and why do we do it? Like, why do we, like, save a heart or a finger or someone who's...
Well, it's a way of... It's a way of honoring the dead, and different cultures have different ways of honoring the dead, and it really varies widely from one culture to another. Here in the modern West, we tend to bury the dead, or sometimes cremate and then dispose of the ashes, such as by burying them. But other cultures have other patterns. This became clear to me a number of years ago. I was talking to a friend from Southeast Asia, and in her culture, once you bury someone, you do not interfere with the grave again.
Mm-hmm.
You leave it alone. And so she had a hard time appreciating Egyptology, because Egyptology involves going into tombs. And to her, that seemed like desecrating a grave. But I would explain to her that from a Western perspective, it's actually our way of honoring these people, because we get to learn about them. We get to understand them better. We get to have knowledge of these people so that they're not forgotten. And so it really depends on what culture you're from, how you honor the dead. Well, in modern American culture, we don't typically keep around the remains of someone after they've died, although that's changing in some quarters with people keeping ashes of relatives in their homes or even having the ashes made into jewelry. And I'm not recommending those practices. I just note that they occur. But in other cultures, one way of honoring someone is by keeping a part of them. And that was true in European cultures during the last 2,000 years. And so it was natural when someone was a special person that you really wanted to remember, like a saint, to want to have a part of their body. And so it became customary to have relics, that's what they're technically called, and to put relics in churches. So many churches will have a relic for the altar of the church. And the practice has kind of waxed and waned over time. It used to be very Catholic for Catholics to be able to obtain relics of saints. In fact, there is a congregation of nuns in Rome that would give people little small relics of a saint, but the Vatican actually stopped that practice a number of years ago, and so these days it's tending to want relics reserved in churches, and it's not actively promoting giving them to the laity, although there's still a lot of them out there.
And I'm going to leave that there and say thanks very much for the call, Peggy. I hope that was helpful to you. I'm realizing lots and lots of folks on the line for Jimmy. And we want to get to George in Kansas next, watching on YouTube. George, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, Sonny. Hey, Jimmy.
Hi, George.
My question is, hopefully this will be a simple one, is I had a discussion with a friend of mine and about Joan of Arc. And mm-hmm. She had said that, well, Joan of Arc was schizophrenic. And I wasn't really sure how to counteract that other than from just being a history buff. The only thing I could rebuttal with, it must have been very helpful. It must have been pretty helpful then if that was the case, because out of 13 engagements, she won 9. So mm-hmm. Maybe help me refine that answering a little bit.
Yeah, so Joan of Arc is, like many saints who have visions or divine revelations, Joan of Arc has been accused of schizophrenia, because there is a form of schizophrenia known as, and also epilepsy, because with schizophrenia you can... One of the symptoms of schizophrenia sometimes is hearing voices. And with epilepsy, especially temporal lobe epilepsy, you can hear voices or see strange visual phenomena that may be interpreted as a religious vision. And it's easy to just look at anybody who has revelations like Joan of Arc reported having, and say, oh, that there must be something wrong with that person. They must be schizophrenic, or they must be epileptic, or something like that. I mean, I've heard the epilepsy charge, for example, made against St. Paul. But just because there are physiological conditions like schizophrenia and epilepsy that can produce voices and visions doesn't mean that all voices and visions are due to pathological conditions like epilepsy or schizophrenia. That just, it doesn't follow. It would be like saying, eggs can be used to make, what's an analogy I want? Eggs can be used to make a breakfast, but that doesn't mean everything that's a breakfast has eggs in it. You know, you can't reason in that way. That's it involves, I mean, depending on how you frame it, it would involve a fallacy known as affirming the consequent. So yeah, it's true that there are pathological conditions that will produce effects like this, but you can't reason backwards from that. You need some evidence that would support this conclusion. And the mere fact that someone hears voices or has visions does not prove it's a pathological condition. So I am unaware of any evidence that Joan of Arc had either schizophrenia or epilepsy. I'm open on that question. I haven't looked into her life story in great detail yet. I do plan on doing an episode of Mysterious World on Joan of Arc in the future. And at that point, I'll have to dig into the evidence and say, is there evidence of a pathology here or not? Even if there is a pathology, though, that doesn't mean that God can't use the pathology. I did an episode a while back on Harriet Tubman, the famous conductor of the Underground Railroad. And she did both report paranormal experiences, and there's evidence that she had temporal lobe epilepsy, because when she was a child, she was in a store and someone threw a 2-pound iron weight at her head, and it struck her head and caused brain trauma. And in later life, she did display symptoms of temporal lobe epilepsy. You know, she would, one of the symptoms is a person will just, in the middle of doing something, will zone out, and they'll just be still for a few minutes, and then they'll resume activity as if nothing happened, except they will feel tired. And that's exactly what happened with Harriet Tubman. So I think there is evidence that Harriet Tubman had temporal lobe epilepsy due to her brain trauma, which concussive brain trauma will cause temporal lobe epilepsy. But she also had paranormal experiences where that appeared to be genuinely precognitive. She would have dreams or visions where she would see something that would happen in the future, and then it would happen. So these appeared to be veridical, meaning truth-oriented or truthful experiences. And okay, so maybe she had a pathology, but maybe that pathology was tied to something genuinely preternatural going on. And if that was true for Harriet Tubman, then hypothetically, the same thing could be true of Joan of Arc. If she did have a pathological condition that was associated with visions, that doesn't mean the visions weren't true. You have to look at are the visions truthful is a separate question than what are they related to on a physiological level. So I'm open-minded about was Joan of Arc, did she have a pathology, I don't have any evidence, and simply saying, oh, she heard voices, therefore she must have been schizophrenic, that is a false inference. Not everyone who hears a voice is schizophrenic, and you would need to see other evidence that she displayed symptoms of schizophrenia in order to reach that conclusion. And of course, it's also, she lived 600 years ago. It's kind of hard to diagnose a person accurately at a distance of 600 years, especially for a mental condition. It's not like we can, dig up her body and do a physiological test and see what physical condition she had.
Yeah. And you couldn't dig up her body anyway.
Yeah.
George.
She had a kind of living cremation. Yeah.
George, are you satisfied with that?
I am. And I just thought about, from your previous caller, I had a follow-up question, if that's okay, real fast.
It's got to be very fast because we are up for the break.
Okay. I inherited a relic, and I already talked to my priest about it, and it's fine. How can I properly venerate the relic pieces that are inside? Would I just take that to my priest, and do we just go that route, or?
Well, if you want to venerate it, you just put it in a reverent place or keep it in a reverent place in your home, maybe not the bathroom, maybe on your mantle or something, and occasionally ask the saint for their intercession or thank God for the saint and the example they gave or something like that. You don't have to do anything in particular. It's really up to you how you would choose to venerate the relics of the saints. You could kiss the reliquary. If you were going to take them to the church, you could always donate them, but you're not required to do that. So it's really up to you, as long as you're reverent in what you do.
Thanks, George. Got to take that break. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
With so many cultural challenges today to the areas of faith, family, and fellowship, I want to help my listeners navigate through some of those challenges to become the best disciples of Jesus Christ that they can become.
EWTN, Open Line Tuesday with Father Wade Menezes. Tonight, 10 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy, of course, author of a whole bunch of things, including The Bible is a Catholic Book and a book that we give away a lot over here called The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. But he's also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, a rapidly growing corner of the internet where people find all kinds of cool stuff.
In fact, lately we've been peaking as the number 8 documentary podcast in the United States, so in the top 10.
Wow. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you.
Do you know any numbers that come with that, or it's just like, well, we know we're in the top 10, but we don't know what that...
Well, no. We know how many downloads and views we have.
Yeah.
We don't know exactly the size of the audience because sometimes families listen together. And so the audience may be more than the number of downloads.
Right, right.
So what we do is we apply a principle that's used in the publishing industry. Like if one newspaper goes to a house, it's probably read on average by more than one person, because the husband will read it, the wife will read it, maybe one of the kids will read it. And so in the publishing industry, 2.2 is a common number that's used as a multiplier from the raw number of copies distributed. And based on that, we have something more than 100,000 listeners per episode. And that's enough that we rank in ranking services. When the new episode comes out, it's been getting up to number 8.
Wow.
On the chart.
Yeah. Darren, any way we can exploit that and take advantage of our connection to Jimmy Akin, his popularity? Yeah. All right. We'll have a meeting about that.
Have me on the show sometime.
Yeah. Okay. Ann in Colorado, you're next, watching on YouTube. Ann, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello there.
Hi.
And good afternoon or evening or wherever you are, huh?
It's kind of afternoon where we are, yeah.
Oh, yes.
We're west of you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate you guys. I'm wanting to know about the Transfiguration. Mm-hmm. Over the years, I've had different priests make different comments on it. And so I just was wondering, why was the Transfiguration? What was the purpose?
So the best way to try to figure out the why of something is by looking at the what of something. I was reading some years ago a book about parables that suggested that one of the best ways to figure out the meaning of a parable is by looking at the figures in the parable. And there's frequently one lesson associated with each figure in the parable. So like in the parable of the prodigal son, well, there's the son who's prodigal, there's the son, there's the father, and then there's the other son who's the good son that stays at home. And they all three interact in this parable. So one of the ways of figuring out what are we supposed to learn from the parable of the prodigal son is by looking at the behavior of each of these individuals. What does the prodigal do? What does the father do? And what does the other son do? And that gives us a good general understanding of the parable. Well, in the case of the Transfiguration, this is not a parable, but I think the same principle applies. If you, you know, if you're trying to figure out why someone is doing something, looking at what they do is a good initial guide. And so in this experience, they go up on a mountain, which is symbolic of going to be in communion with God, you know, because we conceptualize God as being high up, and going up on a mountain is going to commune with God. And while they're there, they see Jesus displaying dazzling qualities that he normally doesn't display. These are a manifestation of heavenly power and heavenly glory. And furthermore, he talks with Moses and Elijah, and Moses and Elijah are two very important figures from the Old Testament. They represent the law, that's Moses, and they represent the prophets, that's Elijah, and it's showing how Jesus is supported by the law and the prophets. Also, the experience is a temporary one. And that's significant because Peter actually says, hey, it's really great to be here. Why don't we set up some tents or shelters, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah, and we can kind of stay up here. But that's not God's will. And so this is meant to be some kind of temporary experience of God's power and glory. Also, just a week before this, and this is in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus predicted that some of his disciples would not die before they saw the kingdom coming in power and glory. And then in each of the three Synoptic Gospels, it says, and 6 days later, or whatever, the Transfiguration happened. So this is apparently the manifestation of God's kingdom in power and glory that Jesus had been speaking of the week previously. And as a result of that, it would appear that this is a supernatural encounter with the power and the glory of God's kingdom that accentuates the role of Jesus, and the heavenly voice of the Father tells the disciples to, this is his beloved son, hear him. So it's focused on the sonship of Jesus and the need to obey Jesus and how Jesus is supported by the law and the prophets. And so communicating those messages to the disciples was the purpose of the Transfiguration. There's also another aspect of this, because it's after the Transfiguration that Jesus sets his face to go to Jerusalem, where he's going to suffer and die. And the disciples have not been appreciating it. They have not been understanding Jesus when he's been telling them he's going to die. And that's going to be a very traumatic experience for them to witness. And so it's very commonly proposed, and I think this is correct, that an additional purpose of the Transfiguration in relation to Jesus's crucifixion, death, and resurrection is it's a strengthening of the disciples' faith, so that when Jesus suffers and dies, they won't be tempted to simply give up faith. It's like, oh man, we thought that guy was a prophet and now he's dead. He couldn't be the Messiah. No, it's meant to give them a foretaste of the heavenly glory and power that is to come, that's on the other side of the crucifixion, to strengthen their faith through the experience of having to witness Jesus's passion.
I'm going to leave that right there, and I hope that that was helpful to you, Anne. I appreciate that. Let's see. Let's go to John in Ohio. John, you're going to have to be—oh, I don't know if I left you enough time, John.
Go. It's fine. It's fine. Go ahead.
John, real quick.
All right. Yeah, because I have two questions, but maybe I'll wait for another time. All right. Well, let me get to it real quick instead of explaining where I heard it from.
Please
what
do.
Is a novena or a prayer, a novena? I heard it on another
okay.
show.
Sure. So what's a novena?
A novena is a group of nine prayers. The word novena comes from the word for nine. And so it's simply a group of nine prayers. It may be done every day, once a day for 9 days. It may be done once an hour for 9 hours. It may just be done nine times in a row really fast. But you can use any prayer. You could have a novena of the Our Father, or a novena of the Hail Mary, or a novena of anything else. It's just a group of nine prayers.
John, you did get that question out quickly and resisted the temptation to give us the backstory. And I appreciate that you did, because otherwise we wouldn't have been able to get you an answer. Jimmy, thanks. Looking forward to seeing you at the conference.
My pleasure. See you there.
Coming up next, Jim Blackburn will be here. So if you're on the line, please hang on the line. We'll do our very best to get to you right away. We come back with Jim Blackburn. If you haven't dialed yet, there are three lines open. It's open forum. Anyone's welcome. 888-318-7884.